Support for WGTD's morning show comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. WGTD is also supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. I have a feeling that many of you listening to the morning show right now are fans of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings and other writings by the great J.R. Tolkien. I have a feeling, though, that even if you are a fan of his works, you may not know actually all that much about Mr. Tolkien himself and the story of how he became who he was and how he came to write such enduring classics that are so beloved here and around the world. Many questions about Tolkien can be answered in a beautifully crafted biography of his, just published, called Tolkien, How an Obscure Oxford Professor Wrote The Hobbit and Became the Most Beloved Author of the Century. The book is written by Devin Brown, who is a Lilly Scholar and Professor of English at Asbury University, where he teaches courses devoted specifically to J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis. He is also the author of Hobbit Lessons and the Christian World of the Hobbit, which are published by the same publisher, Abington Press. He has spoken extensively on both J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis at special conferences here and abroad. And he has done a beautiful job of helping us understand who Tolkien was. Again, this book is titled Tolkien, How an Obscure Oxford Professor Wrote The Hobbit and Became the Most Beloved Author of the Century. Professor Devin Brown, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thanks. It's great to be here.
I am very, very excited to talk with you. And one thing I want to make sure I say right off the bat, and it might be seem like a curious place to begin, but one of the things I really appreciated is the fact is that there is so much in this biography, and yet it's a very modestly sized biography. And for someone who has a lot to read like I do, I appreciated the fact that I wasn't trying to make my way through a 400 or 500 page biography of Mr. Tolkien. I wonder if you could just say a word about the modest size of this biography, and also what kind of challenge that may be presented to you in terms of telling the story as thoroughly as you do, but within the confines of a book that is scarcely 150 pages long.
Yeah. Anyone who sets out to write a new biography of a famous figure needs to either do one of two things. Either needs to have, you know, come across some hidden letters up in a dusty attic somewhere that shed new light on this person, you know, that Tolkien's books were really written by his son or Queen Elizabeth or something crazy. Or they need to take a different slant, because there's already some very good biographies out there. Most people who know Tolkien will know of the Humphrey Carpenter biography, the one written by a very good Tolkien scholar, very good writer, when Tolkien was alive, with his cooperation. So if you're going to do something like this, you got to take a different slant. And like my kind of mouthful of a subtitle suggests, my book tells how an obscure Oxford professor wrote The Hobbit and then became the most beloved author of the century. That's what I focus on, is telling that story. Now, there is such a thing as a comprehensive biography where you learn what his great-great-grandfather did when he was born and things like that. Mine's not that book. Mine does tell this story, and I'll just say this. I think it's a story that's as interesting and as fascinating as any of the stories that Tolkien would go on to write himself.
I quite agree. And I think one of the things that is intriguing is that in some ways it's a surprise. That is, J.R. Tolkien to go on to become this immensely beloved figure. I mean, he did not have brilliance written on every page of his early life. I mean, and if someone were to have seen him at the age of 7 or 11 or 17 or 21, even 27, I mean, they very likely would never have predicted that he was destined for the greatness that he ultimately achieved. And on the other hand, some things that we read about him make it also seem like it wasn't a surprise at all. There are sort of these hints of the greatness that is to come. And I'm just so intrigued that the story of Tolkien is in a sense, the story of both of those aspects.
Well, you're exactly right. I mean, you know, we all know of these musical prodigies, you know, Mozart and Beethoven, who from the very start, it was clear to everybody what they were going to do, and it was just a question of how soon. It didn't take very long. Like you mentioned, Tolkien had some flashes of brilliance as a young person. I mean, he had an incredible ability with language, and he had a deep, deep passion for the myths from the North, Icelandic myths, the Swedish myths, Norse myths. And he could read those in their original languages and was just really good at it. But, yeah, he did not get a full scholarship to Oxford when he was a high school senior. He got a partial one because, well, he'd been messing around with his languages instead of studying for his exams. When he comes up to Oxford as a student, he gets a second, and it's a weak second on his first set of exams, and almost lost his scholarship, almost got booted out. But his tutor said, look, here's the problem. You're studying the wrong stuff. He had come as a classical student, which meant Greek and Latin. And he says, you need to switch over to English, which really meant Old English and Middle English. That's what you love. That's where your passion is. And once that happened, things sort of clicked. Having said that, that wasn't the end of the story. When he comes time to get married, he marries sort of his high school sweetheart, and she's an orphan, like he is at the time, and her guardian isn't too big on this wedding. So she'd been engaged to a farmer, and he thought maybe she should stick with the farmer. At least he had his farm. He wasn't sure that Tolkien would ever make anything out of himself, which, you know, is one of the great understatements in literary history. And even Tolkien, after he got his academic career going, he got a professorship at Leeds University. Then he was offered not one chair, but a second chair at Oxford. It looked like he was just going to be this obscure Oxford professor. He's grading a stack of high school entrance exams, the kind of thing here in America we might call a stack of blue books is sitting right there on his desk one summer. And it's something an Oxford professor would do to make some extra money over the summer, kind of tedious, you know, the kind of thing if you had some extra money you wouldn't do. Anyway, he comes across a blank page in one of them, and he's thrilled because, what, he doesn't have to read it, doesn't have to grade it. And for reasons he says he could never later explain, he scribbles down, in a hole in the ground there lived a hobbit. And he had no more idea than we did, he says, of what a hobbit was or where they lived. But he liked names and liked finding about them. So he starts telling his kids a nighttime bedtime story about this hobbit. And before long, he starts getting his details confused, and his boys keep telling him, you know, last night you said it was this dwarf who wore the blue cap or whatever. So he starts to write it down, and from that gradual, rather humble beginning, you know, we get The Hobbit today.
I really love a story that you tell in the prologue, which also sort of underscores the good fortune it is that this book even exists. At one point you say, The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings may, without exaggeration, both be described as books that very nearly weren't. And to help illustrate that, you tell us the story of a 10-year-old boy who played a surprisingly significant role, actually, in this first Tolkien work being published. Tell our listeners about this.
Yeah, so after Tolkien starts writing down this Hobbit story, just a story for his kids, there's a friend of his who gets the flu in Oxford, and to help her recover, you know, back then there's no internet, there's not even much radio or TV, he lends her this unfinished manuscript of The Hobbit. She kind of likes it. One of his students happens to be living with this woman. She borrows it and likes it. And this student's roommate ends up working for a London publisher, Allen & Unwin. And this never happens today. People, I'm sure, listening have all tried to get books published or have thought about it. Anyway, this publisher said, look, if you'll finish this book, we'd like to take a look at it. Nowadays, you send your book and beg that somebody would take a look at it. Well, Tolkien does finish up here. I think at that one point we'd gotten kind of where the second movie ends up, with Smaug taken off and maybe being killed by Bard. Anyway, he finishes it up and he sends it in, and Stanley Unwin, who's the publisher, always had his son Rainer, who was 10 years old, read books that children might read, and you know, he was part of the review process, and if he liked it, they published it, and if he liked it, well, they thought maybe they shouldn't, right? So anyway, he writes his little report, and I've got it here. It says, Bilbo Baggins was a hobbit who lived in a hobbit hole and never went for adventures. At last, Gandalf the wizard and his dwarves persuaded him to go. This book, with the help of maps, does not need any illustrations. It is good and should appeal to all children. Rainer gets a shilling, a coin that I think was worth maybe 12 pence. And with that recommendation, The Hobbit went on and got published. And we could say, I think without exaggeration, that for a brief moment, the fate of Middle-earth was in the hands of this 10-year-old reviewer.
And we all are thankful that he liked it as much as he did.
Yeah,
well, yeah. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Professor Devin Brown, who is the author of a book called Tolkien, How an Obscure Oxford Professor Wrote The Hobbit and Became the Most Beloved Author of the Century. Actually, we should take a moment to just talk about kind of the other half of the prologue ahead of this charming story you just recounted. Actually tries to put into proper perspective just how beloved these books like The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, in fact, are in the pantheon of great beloved classics. You cite some interesting statistics that really help put it in perspective.
Yeah, it was crazy. I mean, for your listeners who were around at the turn of the century and the millennium, you know, there was this millennium craze, and half of the attention was turned to this millennium bug. Was everything going to stop working? Our microwaves, our internet, you know, your telephone, and did you need to stockpile water? And the other craze was, well, what was the best book of the century, best author of the century, best, I don't know, whatever, of the millennium? We had all these lists coming on. And so, you know, people love lists, and book lovers love lists. And so all these bookstores, Waterston's over in England, the BBC in England, Amazon here in the States, had readers, you know, vote for the author of the century or best book of the millennium or whatever, one of those two things. And I guess to everyone's surprise, except for Tolkien fans, in list after list, competition after competition, Tolkien gets named as the favorite author. Lord of the Rings comes in at number one. Hobbit is not far behind. A couple lists of top 20 lists. There's only two authors in the top 20. Shakespeare is one, and Tolkien's the other. He's got two books in the top 20. And it caused such an uproar that people at one point, you know, very serious highbrow academics, were sure that a couple of these had been rigged, that all these Tolkien fans had gotten together and stuffed the ballot box or gotten their sisters and brothers and uncles and aunts to vote. Anyway, so as the results came in for multiple competitions, and Tolkien wins again and again and again and again, it became clear that he was the truly, among everybody, not just academics, but among people in general, he was definitely the most beloved author of the century. And let's just say this, he's doing pretty good in the 21st century as well.
It's really true, isn't it?
Yeah.
You asked me before we went on the air if I happen to be a Tolkien fan, and so let me turn the tables on you, since you're the guest after all. It's pretty clear, obviously, that you care a lot about Mr. Tolkien and what he represents and what he has written. At what point did you first encounter his work, and what about it caught your attention and grabbed your heart so forcefully?
Yeah, when my students at Esbury know that I'm teaching a Tolkien class, they think that somehow I took classes in Tolkien in the undergrad and maybe did my dissertation. And in fact, you know, when I was going to school, there were no classes in Tolkien. And truth be told, he wasn't nearly as well known when I was younger as he is now. I mean, everybody knows about The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, perhaps because of the movies or other things. But I grew up on the south side of Chicago, kind of a blue-collar area where, you know, books by British authors were a bit in short supply. My family, I was in middle school, and my family was going on a camping trip to northern Indiana, and I knew that I would be sitting for 2 weeks at a cement picnic table in some Indiana state park while the rest of my family was out paddle boating or nature hiking or having the time of their lives. I'm the one family member who doesn't like camping. So I went to the local library, and back then you could only check out 5 books. And let's be honest, if a middle school boy walked into a library today and asked if he could take 6, you know, they'd have a parade. The boy wants 6 books, The balloons would fall down from the ceiling. Anyway, I could only take five, so I wanted five big fat ones. And so I took five big fat books off the science fiction fantasy shelf. Didn't care who had written them or what they were. I just needed big ones. And I don't remember what the fifth one was, but the four books that I ended up with were The Hobbit and then the three Lord of the Rings books. So,
and you literally kind of chose them because of their girth?
Because of their girth. They were the big, and you know how library books are. They're the big hardcover ones, and they had that plastic, shell outside to protect them. And even then, the covers weren't that cool. They were kind of strange. But I didn't care. They were big, and I thought they'd see me through this terrible camping trip. So anyway, my family's off doing something one afternoon, and I pop open the first book. And anybody who's read The Hobbit, not seen the movie, but read The Hobbit, knows that Tolkien takes this kind of odd authorial stance where he pretends like he's, telling a real story, right? There's these creatures called hobbits, and they used to be more numerable. Nowadays, you hardly see them at all. And for about the first 20 minutes there, as a middle school boy at that cement picnic table, I actually thought they were real, and it was pretty magical. And after a while, I figured, okay, he's doing something here that a middle school boy didn't quite get. But I know they're not real. But for a while, yeah, I thought they were real. So that's how it started. And, I'll say this. I am a big Tolkien fan, but there are levels and levels of Tolkien fans. So when I go to, a Tolkien conference, there are Tolkien conferences where everyone's very prim and proper and reads their very formal papers like any other academic conferences. But there's a couple conferences where they begin with a procession where people dress up as various characters. And, I don't dress up as a hobbit. I'm not going to put on the big feet and the hairy toes, and I'm not going to be an elf or a dwarf or Gandalf. About the furthest I'll go is I'll put on my academic gown and go as Tolkien. So.
There you go.
There.
That's a great story about what pulled you to choose these books in the first place. In some ways, it's yet another example of the unlikelihood of life. I mean, that sometimes very, very important decisions with far-reaching long-term consequences can turn on the smallest of matters, like how thick the book is on the shelf.
Yeah, or Bilbo Baggins putting his hand out in the Misty Mountains and coming across a golden ring there in the darkness.
Very
yeah,
cool.
I was just thinking that same connection.
So let's get into a few interesting details about Mr. Tolkien and the biography which we're talking about, again called Tolkien, How an Obscure Oxford Professor Wrote The Hobbit and Became the Most Beloved Author of the Century. He was born on the 3rd of January in 1892, and the name of where he was born is formidable. I'll let you pronounce it.
Well, I usually say Bloemfontein, and, his dad was one of these Brits who went in search of a better living. So the way to do that better and quicker was to go to one of the colonies. So he goes off to South Africa, which at that time England was sort of in charge of, and became a bank manager in a way that he would have remained a clerk for the longest time. After he gets this bank manager job, he invites his fiancée, Tolkien's mother, over, and they get married in South Africa, and J.R. Tolkien is born not in England, not in green and pleasant Oxford, but in dry, dusty South Africa. And, yeah, he's born in 1892, so, there's not a lot of authors that are born in the 1800s that are still read today, and I mean read by your average Joe, not read in some lit class, but read by all sorts of people. And so, yeah, we could say that his life and his work and his legacy and influence now spans, three centuries. He's born in the 19th century.
Hmm.
He grows up there. He spends the first 4 years of his life there. And everyone points to this incident. Even he mentions, he says, yes, it is true. He got bit by a tarantula. And his nurse, who was taking care of him, he goes running off through the weeds, and his nurse chases after him, grabs him, sucks out the poison. It's one of these tales from childhood that maybe everybody has of a brush with death. Now, that tale would be just an interesting tale, except anybody who knows his story knows that evil, wicked spiders figure really prominently in both of them, right? So Bilbo, we saw it in the first movie where he fights off these big spiders with Sting, and he's got his ring, and they're trying to take all the dwarves and wrap them up and eat them. And then, of course, we meet Shelob in The Lord of the Rings, where where Frodo and Sam are trying to get through the mountains into Mordor, and they go through Shelob's lair, and, of course, she stings Frodo. So he said, now, I wasn't really drawn on this, but I don't know. boy gets bitten by a tarantula, two great villain spiders in both of his big books. I think there's a connection there.
there just has to be. One of the sadder aspects of Tolkien's childhood is that he loses his father very, very early. In fact, I think so early that essentially he has no memories of his father, or significant memories.
His family goes. His mom, of course, wants to go back to England. She's not working there, and it's hot. And truth be told, Tolkien is not doing so well with the heat. So the dad's going to have a furlough. He's been putting it off. You know how new bank managers must be. So the deal is she's going to take the two boys, and Tolkien has a younger brother, and they're going to sail back to England, and their dad's going to join them. And in fact, he dies before he can get back there, leaving his young widow and his two orphan sons there back in England. So he loses his father pretty early, and about age 4, and about age 12, he loses his mother. And again, this would be just interesting details, but, you know, Tolkien has these huge appendices at the end of The Lord of the Rings, and we all know Frodo's parents are gone when we start The Lord of the Rings, but we don't know when they vanished. He's come to live with his uncle Bilbo, right? But it turns out Frodo loses his parents at age 12, the exact same age that Tolkien lost his mother and became an orphan. Tolkien becomes taken under the guardianship of Father Francis, their local priest, very wise spiritual figure in his life. Well, Aragorn kind of has that same role. So Frodo becomes a mentee or pupil of Bilbo and is raised by him. Aragorn loses his father, and he gets taken to Rivendell as a young boy, where he's raised by Elrond. So yeah, Tolkien certainly drew on elements from his own life. I'll just say this, that I don't like to do a lot of psychoanalyzing. I mean, look, my people in English do this all the time, and I'm not a big fan of it, but it is strange to say that C.S. Lewis and Tolkien, the inventors of Narnia and Middle-earth, both lost their mother at a young age. Now, what losing your mother when you're a young child does exactly to the storytelling process isn't quite clear, but it does seem a bit strange. And it wouldn't seem so strange if we didn't also have to point to George MacDonald, who had lost his mother at a young age, and J.K. Rowling, whose mother died before as she was just getting started writing the Harry Potter book. So
there's something
connection. I don't know what to make of it, but it's there.
Right. It's and I think you say something I think very perceptive, and you also don't say too much when you say when it came time to write his fiction, fatherless characters and foster fathers would appear in key roles. Notable among them, Frodo, who is raised by Bilbo, who is. And Aragorn, who is only 2 when his father dies and is subsequently raised by Elrond. Just ahead of that, Tolkien pointed out that despite the fact that, and with very little memory of his father, Tolkien was more influenced by his absence than anything that he had said or done. And it's so interesting to think about being influenced by an absence.
Yeah, I mean, the lack of a father is a huge thing that's going to stay with you and affect you forever, and it's something he knew deeply. The more we look at this, the more we find. So when we get to the writers of Rohan there in The Lord of the Rings, Arwen, the two characters that don't have their fathers gone. We get to Gondor, Faramir, and Boromir. Their mother's dead. So you know, I don't know anybody's got. Oh, yeah, and Arwen, Liv Taylor, who plays her in the movie, her mother has been attacked by orcs, and she's gone over the sea. I think you have to look really hard to find anybody who's got two parents left. Hmm. Even Samwise Gamgee, he's got the old gaffer, and his mom is gone. So, you know, missing parents are all over those books, and it's something that stayed with Tolkien all his life.
Right. As for his mother, with whom he did enjoy a few years before she also sadly dies while he is still quite young, but she is an important figure for him, and not only as just a loving, attentive mother, but also for some of the things that were of great interest to her. For instance, you tell us that Tolkien's mother was very interested in botany.
That's right.
And this is a theme which plays out pretty dramatically in what he would go on to write many years later.
Yeah. I mean, if Tolkien were alive today, we'd call him a tree hugger, right? He's this guy who loved trees. And anybody who loves Tolkien has seen a picture of him under his favorite pine tree there in the Oxford Botanical Gardens, this big 300-year-old pine tree. And, you know, he loved trees. And we see that in the Ent figures. And he's a big proponent of the natural world and saving what's green and good out there. Well, this is something he picked up from his mother, who knew quite a bit practical botany. I mean, she wasn't a botanist. She wasn't a scientist. But she really taught him a love for nature and a love for plants. Hmm. She was also pretty good in languages, and she taught him languages from an early age. She also passed on her Catholic faith to him. That was a big factor in his writing. So, yeah, his mother really was quite an influence on his, I don't know, intellectual ability, his spiritual side, probably his psychological side. So before she passed away, she really molded him. There's that famous saying, the child is the father of the man. And in some ways, we see a lot of the elements of Tolkien the man in Tolkien the child.
By the way, you say that during this period, this four-year period that they live in, do we call it Serhol?
Yeah, I call it Serhol.
Okay. You say both he and Hillary were taught at home by their mother.
Yep.
Was that common in that time and place for children to be, in a sense, homeschooled? Something that we think about a lot today or see a lot today, but I think most of us think of it as a fairly kind of newfangled development.
Yeah, we certainly do. We think of it as some new deal, but early childhood education, which we now kind of assign to Head Start or daycare or kindergarten, was really taken on at home. And I don't mean just, you know, learn to color and finger paint. This was some serious reading and studying. And I think, at least in Tolkien's case, the child's mind can do a lot more than people expect it to. So, yeah, they were schooled at home. Now, they hit a point, and it's not that here kids are often homeschooled, and I get a lot of homeschoolers when I teach college here, who have been homeschooled, you know, all the way through high school or maybe up into high school. Well, at that, you know, there came a time where it was time for Tolkien to go to school. And so, you know, you get to age 7 or 8 or 9, and then it's time to go to school. But up until then, yeah, this was done at home and done in a pretty serious way.
Hmm. You tell us that when he was about 7 years old, Tolkien sat down and did one of his first serious writings, and he decided to write about a dragon. And I love this little story, which he evidently recounts in a letter he wrote to the great poet W.H. Auden in 1955. And he says that he doesn't remember very much about exactly what he wrote, but he does remember something very specific that his mother said. Do you remember the story that I'm talking about?
Yeah. He started to write things, and he wants to say, once upon a time, there was a green great dragon. And she says, no, honey, you actually have to say great green dragon. So on one hand, Tolkien's imagination is fired by this idea of a dragon, a great dragon, a green dragon. And then the other side, he's intrigued, and he, even at this very young age, that adjectives that go in front of a noun actually have a certain order that we actually learn subconsciously. Right? I mean, everyone would say that once upon a time there was a great green dragon, not a green great dragon. And so that idea of, well, how does languages work? What are the rules that abide them? You know, and there's something magical. How do we know that? And yet we all do know that. So, you know, later on he went on to invent his own languages. You know, the elves actually have a couple languages. We hear the dwarves speak in their language. And, of course, there's the black language that the ring has inscribed, you know, one ring to rule them all. Well, we find that in the book, and, of course, it's said in the movie, Ash, Naz, Gingatuk, you know, that sort of thing. So, yeah, Tolkien had this very deep passion and, of course, a great ability for language that began even way back then.
A couple of very important things occur that we need to talk about, and one of them, you've already mentioned that his mother Mabel was a person for whom her religious faith was very, very important, and I think you've even already mentioned the fact that she was Catholic. I don't think we've yet mentioned the fact that she actually converted to Catholicism much to the, I was going to say chagrin, I don't think that's the sufficient term.
No,
the way you describe it, it's horror, the horror of her relatives and her, and I think her, maybe her husband's relatives even. I mean, she makes all kinds of people unhappy with that decision to convert to Catholicism. And I suppose that's not a surprise given the time and place that we're talking about. What do you think were kind of the ongoing ramifications of this, particularly for Tolkien? I mean, in what kind of a difference did this make for him both then and in the years to come?
It's interesting. In studying any figure, you also get to study the times they lived in, which I think is you know, half of the fun. And so to go back into Tolkien's boyhood, the early 1900s, late 1800s, things were different then. It was such a big deal what denomination you were. And maybe some of your listeners can identify, if they're as old as you and I are. You know, back when we were boys, it was kind of a big difference. Do you want your children to date a Catholic or marry a Methodist or whatever you are or aren't, right? If you're Jewish, do they have to marry somebody else who's Jewish? I think it's wonderful that some of these animosities have subsided somewhat. But boy, in Tolkien's boyhood day, they were huge. And so the fact that his mother, who's now a young widow, converts from Anglicanism to Catholicism, you know, was a shock and horror to all her relatives, who immediately responded in what I would call one of the most unchristian-like fashions, when basically disowned her. So now she has very little money to live on, and very little family support, just because she's a different denomination they are. Tolkien, of course, became a Catholic with her, remained a Catholic all of his life, and, you know, it's hard to speculate exactly what that meant, but you have to feel like the persecution that his mother received and the animosity that she received from her family, her relatives, probably made him more of a staunch Catholic, more of a serious Catholic than he might have been otherwise. In other words, if she was going to be persecuted for her faith, well, then this is something that he had to take quite seriously, because she sacrificed quite a bit to pass it on to him. So he becomes a very serious Christian, and just to follow the story out to its end, everyone today knows C.S. Lewis as quite a famous Christian writer. What they may not know is that Tolkien was instrumental in bringing him to faith. When Lewis and Tolkien first met, Lewis was a great atheist, and Tolkien was an equally serious Christian. Lewis thought he'd be the one to influence Tolkien, and in fact, it was the other way around.
Hmm. There is that moment in 1904 when Mabel Tolkien dies and leaves her sons essentially as orphans. And of course, we've already touched upon how this kind of loss played a very deep role in kind of shaping the emotional life of Tolkien from that point on. Tell us on a more practical level about what happened in the wake of Mabel's sudden death.
Yeah, so she's, you know, rightly concerned, who's going to raise my kids and how are they going to raise them? You know, if one of the relatives raise them, they're not going to be allowed to practice the Catholic faith. So she names their local parish priest, Father Francis, as their guardian. And he does work with the family to kind of keep them in touch with their relatives, but he's in charge of them, and he's in charge of raising them and raising them Catholic. A number of interesting things happen because of that, and I don't mean interesting bad. So one thing is that they get put in a boarding house because they got to live somewhere, and they can't live at the rectory, Tolkien and his brother Hilary. And at this boarding house, there's another orphan, Edith Bratt, who in fact becomes Tolkien's wife later on. So he meets her. The other thing is that, you know, he's looking for companionship and friendship because normal family fellowship is limited. And so he has these friends at school, and they all sort of like the same stories, and gradually it evolves. They form this little club, and clubs were bigger back then. That's one of the things you find out when you study history. Everybody had all sorts of clubs and was a member of multiple clubs. Anyway, they formed the TCBS, the Tea Club Barrovian Society, because they meet at Barrow's store for tea. Well, this TCBS, this high school literary reading club, where they would share their love of myth and language, read stories aloud, read things they've written, really becomes a forerunner of the Inklings, the writing group that Lewis and Tolkien would form at Oxford, that from which would come, you know, all these great fantasy stories today.
And I just love that picture of these boys gathering together, for what, in a sense, has all the trappings of some kind of illicit gathering, except that instead of, you know, smoking behind the tool shed or sneaking into the basement and looking at, you know, dirty magazines, what they're doing is gathering in secret to talk about writing.
Yeah, and the lovely illicit element is they first met in the library, and they would had this crazy way of making tea on one of the radiators. And of course, back then, you know, you didn't dare have any food in the library. Our library at Asbury now, man, we've got Starbucks coffee and we've got muffins. It's a great place to go and study. You know, and the world hasn't ended because, you know, you can drink coffee in the library. It's actually gotten a lot better. But, you know, so they would sneak in food, and of course that made it more fun. What do you got today? What do you got? And they'd make tea in the back, and then while they were having their tea, they would talk about these great stories. And you know, that kind of passion for story. I mean, I usually tell my students, all great writers, and of course all my creative writing kids want to write the next great novel, they all begin as great readers. And I just tell you, a lot of students today want to skip over that first stage.
Mm.
Yeah, I want to be a great writer, but I don't want to read all this and this and this. Well, I don't think it works that way. Tolkien's a great example. I mean, he spent lots of time reading before he became a great writer. When he first started to write, it wasn't very good.
Mm. I'm intrigued by the way you describe him as a student. For as great a success as he was to achieve, and for the fact that he went on to become a professor, he does not exactly have a sterling, spotless academic record as a student. And it's not because he wasn't intelligent, and it's not because he didn't care. I mean, the reason for his kind of rocky academic life, it's kind of a complicated picture, as you describe it. I mean, it isn't because he was dumb. It's not because he was lazy. It's just because sometimes what he was most passionate about didn't line up with the work he had to do.
Yes, it's weird. I mean, he read and studied all the time. He just didn't always read and study what he was going to be tested on. And so when he actually took the test, he wasn't as prepared as he might have been. But, you know, he was really great in other areas. When he came time to take these first round of tests, his honor mods, he got a second class instead of a first pass. And he said, really, he probably would have gotten lower except on one of his tests that tested his languages. He got a perfect score, which is like unheard of at that stage. And so, yeah, he was very spotty in that respect. He studied what he liked to study, and when he studied that, he was incredible. And when he got off it, forget it, right? So he was pretty mediocre. We see this picture a little bit, by the way, in Bilbo Baggins, who, you know, from the very first scene of The Lord of the Rings, he's pictured there at Bag End writing down his memoirs in that big red book that at the end of the thing he passes on to Frodo because he's finished the tale, at least his part of it, and Frodo's going to finish it up. Well, Bilbo's a dabbler. He likes to write a little bit of poetry. He'll draw some pictures. But it takes him the longest time to finish his story there and back again, just the first story of The Hobbit. And in this, we get, an image of Tolkien himself, mm-hmm. who was quite the dabbler. He would work on something, and at some point he'd say, well, gosh, we're here at Balin's tomb. What kind of runes should be on there? So he'd invent all these dwarf runes and ways of writing and language, and before you know it, you know, it's been weeks since, and the story hasn't moved forward. He spent time figuring out what language should be on it, who carved the language on this, who's the guy's father who carved the language on it. So, yeah, he got distracted. Having said that, the fact that he finally finished and did it this way, there's a depth to Middle-earth that we don't find in most fantasies. Most fantasies are pretty lightweight compared to The Lord of the Rings and the deep, deep history that's behind The Hobbit.
Fair enough. I think one of the most interesting examples of his sometimes distracted state, you know, it's not that he was distracted by the latest issue of Sports Illustrated that just came in the mail or whatever the British counterpart would have been back then, but
yep.
But I mean, he would be distracted by having just begun reading something in Finnish.
That's right.
And a complicated language like Finnish would absorb all of this time and energy that you know, had he been able to devote that to the more central academic matters at hand, he probably would have done so much better. But his far-reaching interests and level of inquisitiveness just made that impossible for him.
Yeah, and that's the kooky thing about this story, is that all these sidetracks that nearly did him in were the very sidetracks that made him so great at telling the story he finally did tell. Without that background and finish, without all this dabbling, and, you know, he loved to draw, he loved to make letters. Without all that sort of dabbling, The Lord of the Rings wouldn't be nearly what it is, or The Hobbit. So the very thing that almost cost him his scholarship and got him sent down, as they say over there, is the very thing that makes his fiction so incredible.
Mm. We need to talk for a moment about Edith, the woman whom he ultimately marries. You talk about her and about their courtship, and I think all we really have time to talk about, because I think it's an especially intriguing part of the story, is why there was this drastic interruption in their courtship, which almost resulted in her marrying somebody else.
Yeah, and we get a hint of this when Aragorn wants to marry Arwen, and Elrond says, well, you can't marry her until we figured this out. Are you going to be the Return of the King guy in the third book or what? After you're king and have the scepter, then we can talk about marrying. But until then, you know, all bets are off. Well, Tolkien had a similar situation in his life. He'd met this other orphan girl, Edith Bratt, when they're living in the same boarding house, and, you know, she's a little older than he is. And I don't know, now that sounds awfully tame to have a 17-year-old hanging out with a 20-year-old or something like that. But then, you know, oh my, it was scandalous. And, you know, things were so prim and proper back then. They had to go behind the back of the woman who owned the boarding house and behind Father Francis's back. And so they met secretly. And, of course, when their guardians found out, they were horrified. Horrified not so much that they were meeting, but that they'd been meeting and they didn't know about it. It seemed highly improper. So they were forbidden to do so, and guess what? They met again. And at that point, Father Francis said, look, here's the deal. I can't really trust you. And, you know, today they might have gone to a counselor and worked out something a little bit less drastic. But Father Francis said, I forbid you to see her until you're no longer a youth, no longer completely under my guardianship, age 21. So Tolkien says, okay. He says goodbye to Edith. He begins to study more seriously to get into Oxford, which he does. And at midnight on his 21st birthday, when the clock strikes midnight, he's free. He's kept his vow. He writes her. Turns out she's married to engaged to the farmer then. Well, the farmer gets his ring back within a week, and they get engaged and stay married the rest of their lives. But it's quite an interesting story then.
It truly is.
You can almost say it's the marriage that almost wasn't.
Like, right.
The books almost weren't.
Absolutely. Yeah. You also tell us that their marriage occurred practically on the eve of Tolkien enlisting in the army, because World War I has begun. And in that terrible conflict, it was already, even fairly early in that conflict, it was already quite evident that this was going to be an especially bloody war. And you tell us that Tolkien saw plenty of terrible things in the time that he was a soldier in the First World War. And there's no question that this also had to have left a very lasting imprint upon his soul.
Yeah, I mean, we're disturbed, and rightly so by the numbers that come out of the Mideast, and we hear about dozens or 100 people being killed. Well, World War One, those numbers were staggering. I don't think we can even appreciate the idea of thousands and thousands of people being killed in a single day. It was just overwhelming. So when Tolkien marries Edith and goes off to fight in World War One, she says goodbye to him at the train station, and it's very true. It's very likely they'll never see each other again. And people who know about World War One know that entire villages lost all the men in them, or most of the men. So he goes off to World War One. He fights at the Battle of the Somme, and you know it's as bloody as they say, and it goes on for the longest time. And he's saved because he gets trench fever. And comes back home to recuperate. And back then, there's really no antibiotics for it. You just come back in the hospital and try and stay warm and dry and have some decent food. And Edith goes to see him. And he gradually gets nursed back to pretty good health. But it's on again, off again. And, you know, it definitely saved his life. The rest of his battalion is all lost over the coming weeks and months there. And so when we get to writing The Lord of the Rings comes out after World War II in 1954. And everybody wants to say, the ring, that must be the atomic bomb, because, you know, they, at this point, they've just finished World War II. And Baradur, well, that must be Berlin. You know, they're all trying to find these allegories. And, you know, he hated allegory. He says, no. And he said, besides, he said, any of the battle imagery I got, I got from the battle I was in. And I started this way before World War II broke out. So, yeah, when we see that famous scene of Frodo and Sam being led by Gollum over the dead marshes there on their way to Mordor, with the corpses all around and not a green thing in sight, of course, this is Tolkien drawing on his memories of No Man's Land at the Battle of the Sun. There are great battles in The Lord of the Rings, and, you know, they're pretty serious, and they're not fun, and he never glorifies fighting. And, you know, this is something he learned in World War I and kept with him.
Mm. Well, he is fortunate indeed to survive that. I think at one point in your book you said it was his brush with death in terms of ill health, this terrible illness that probably saved his life. And you quote Tolkien himself saying that by the year 1918, all but one of his closest friends had all died or been killed. So this was a young man who tasted more loss than most of us can begin to conceive.
Yeah, and you know, his beloved friends from the TCBS, these high school friends, and I think this was pretty typical in World War One. All went off to fight, every single one of them. And, you know, a short time later, is he and one other friend are the only ones left alive. And so part of this is he feels, he gets this famous letter from one of them. He says, you know, I might die tonight. If I do, you've got to carry on the great, this is kind of glorified, but nevertheless, it turned out to be true. You have to carry on the great tradition of the TCBS guys, and you have to write what I could never write if I'm scuppered tonight. And in fact, he was. So part of this push that Tolkien feels, you know, that maybe I'm supposed to say something, maybe I'm supposed to bring this sort of light of literature to the world and hope and all that sort of stuff through literature, is born there with all these people dying, all his great friends dying in World War One.
Well, of course, what ultimately ensues is a career in academia, which leads to this career as one of the century's most beloved, if not the most beloved of all authors. And your biography, of course, takes us right through to the end of this extraordinary story. But we'll have to leave it to our listeners to take your wonderful book in hand to explore some of the details we haven't explored yet, and to, of course, explore the end of this extraordinary life, this extraordinary story. The book is Tolkien, How an Obscure Oxford Professor Wrote The Hobbit and Became the Most Beloved Author of the Century. The book is published by Abington Press and the author, Devin Brown. Professor Brown, I congratulate you on a wonderfully crafted biography. I loved every page, and I'm so glad we got to talk about it today on The Morning Show. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Professor Art Sear from Carthage College pays his monthly visit to the program to offer analysis of current events. On Wednesday, I replay my interview with Debbie Irving, whose fascinating book, Waking Up White, is one of the most intriguing books about racism to be published in recent years. On Thursday, the monthly visit of the United Environmental Council. And on Friday, we will hear from the author of a brand new and highly regarded biography of Napoleon Bonaparte. Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, a proud supporter of WGTV's Morning Show. Support also comes to you from Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu.